in the matter of Patricia and Gracia versus Eric Luzcategui. May we please have appearances? Welcome, counsel. I note that the attorneys collectively have asked for about an hour and three quarters. We will not need that much for this case, and I'm going to invite you to adopt arguments that others have advanced, and please don't expect to be able to use all of the time that you had requested. Mr. Cannelli, please.
May it please the court, I'd respectfully request 5 minutes rebuttal at the conclusion of the argument.
We'll have you back, perhaps for a little less. Go ahead.
Thank you. This court has stated that an automobile policy is for the benefit of the public and the benefit of those who are injured in automobile accidents. This case stands in stark relief as to what the purpose of auto insurance is for. Officer Jason Mauld was killed by an intoxicated driver on the morning of November 25th, 2010. The vehicle that caused that accident was a vehicle owned by Hunterdon Motors, driven by Mr. Eric Luzcategui, who had obtained that vehicle as a loaner vehicle from Hunterdon Motors for no fee. That vehicle was insured by Hunterdon Motors through Federated Mutual Insurance Company. And the issue before the court is whether my client is entitled to the benefit of coverage under policies of insurance issued for that vehicle being a loaner vehicle intended to be driven by customers of Hunterdon Motors. For over 50 years, this court has uniformly held that someone driving a vehicle with the permission of the owner is automatically an additional insured under those motor vehicle policies of insurance that insure that vehicle. That is called the initial permission rule. It was adopted by this court in Maddox versus Nationwide in 1960, and it has stood unchallenged for over five decades. In adopting that rule, this court said the purpose of adopting the initial permission rule was to provide certain and maximum benefits for the injured party. In that case, the person had their own coverage under a separate policy with Allstate, the driver. But this court found they were also entitled to coverage under the vehicle that caused the accident. Three fundamental rules are at issue in this case. The first is that Mr. Luzcategui is automatically an additional insured under the case law, starting with Maddox. The second is that this court has said that an insurance company cannot adopt an exclusion that eliminates the permissive user rule, including those that base it on the existence of coverage. And that was the decision of Willis versus Century Insurance, adopted in 1969 and affirmed by this court, affirmed OB. And the third is that the rule, this idea, the public policy of protecting innocent victims by coverage, extends regardless of the caption that an insurance company places on the policy. So it makes no distinction if a policy is a primary policy, an excess policy, or an umbrella policy. And that rule was set forth quite clearly by Justice Lavecchia in Gazzis versus Miller, where this court wrote that the strong public policy in favor of spreading the risk of protecting innocent victims of automobile accidents permeates our approach to primary policies of automobile policies and logically extends to excess policies acquired to enhance the amount of liability coverage. It is my opinion that this case is governed by those simple principles in this case. The vehicle in question was required to be insured by both the statutes and regulations of this state to cover users exactly like Mr. Luzcategui. This vehicle was being used as intended. This is not a case on the periphery of the law of what a vehicle is being used for. This was a loaner car intended to be driven by a customer, by a dealership that places 50 some odd vehicles on the road each day for this precise use. I believe that the public policy as set forth in those cases and other cases by this court clearly stands for the proposition that the goal of that insurance is to protect innocent victims in this case. And I would submit the appellate division in this case was misguided in relying upon an underinsured decision in Aubrey versus Harleysville. We would ask that this court reverse the decision of the appellate division and find coverage under both of the policies that insured the vehicle that caused the accident.
Can I ask you to focus on Federated's garage policy and the critical issue that the appellate division wrestled with, whether this was a valid step down or an illegal escape clause? You mentioned the Aubrey case. Tell us why its reasoning should not apply here.
I don't believe Aubrey applies for the reasons I just indicated regarding public policy. I also don't believe Aubrey applies in the liability context. Aubrey is an underinsured motorist case. As Aubrey even quoted, underinsured is designed to protect the person who has the foresight to purchase insurance to protect themselves, quoting Appleman. That's what underinsured motorist coverage is about. Underinsured motorist coverage is created by Title 17. This is a creature of Title 39. They are distinct, in my opinion, distinct areas of law.
Why? The contract, the insurance contract in Aubrey is substantially similar to the one in this case. True?
True. However,
So I understand why you want to make a distinction between first party and third party, but does it flow from your argument? Because from what I'm hearing, you're saying that a step down is, forget about, the step down itself is unlawful.
In my opinion, a step down for a permissive user is unlawful. I don't read this court's decisions.
On what do you base that opinion?
I'm sorry?
On what do you base your opinion that it's unlawful? A step down clause where a policy provides more coverage for its own users but less coverage, which is what a step down is, as opposed to a escape clause where they provide no coverage. They limit their coverage. Why can't a contract provide that?
As to a permissive user using the vehicle as intended, I don't believe this court has said you can have distinct liability limits for a permissive user. And I would cite to the Willis case,
would that make umbrella policies illegal too, as well as excess coverage policies?
I'm sorry, would it make?
Would that make an umbrella policy illegal under your analysis also, any umbrella policy? Because they only come in after a certain amount is exhausted. Or how about a excess policy that only comes in afterwards? Under that analysis, would they also be illegal?
In my opinion, the excess policy would also cover a permissive user, and an exclusion which said I'm excluding that user, in effect, I'm excluding public policy, is unlawful.
Well, that would be a step down, would it not? That would be an escape clause, not a step down, which we have ruled that they're illegal, but a step down is different.
A step down has been permitted by this court in the context of a loading and unloading incident. The court said in Potenzone that you could have a step down as to the type of coverage. The court was not discussing the user of the vehicle in Potenzone. In the context of underinsureds, this court has said you can have step downs, but in the liability context, the only case which has discussed step downs is in the context of whether you could have a step down for the purpose of loading and unloading of a vehicle, as to the user of the vehicle.
So there seem to be two classes of people in this case. The people who work for the dealership, any one of which who operates a vehicle is going to be an agent of the dealership and is not going to be able to access their own personal insurance. I would think, since they're operating a business vehicle. Whereas this class of loaners, they wouldn't seem to be agents of the dealership. And under our law, it seems that they're able to access their personal insurance. Is that a factor that comes into play in this case, or should we be ignoring that?
I don't see that as a factor. In Mattitz, the driver exhausted her primary insurance. And this court said she likewise had coverage under the vehicle she was driving. Willis did the same thing. The person had coverage under their own vehicle, and the coverage was found under the dealership.
But the cases you cite did not involve a step-down. They were simply whether a permissive user has the available coverage from his own policy as well as the vehicle, but there was no step-down. So there
actually, Willis excluded coverage if the person had their own insurance.
But that's not a step-down. That's an escape clause. Yeah.
If the result of the clause is to eliminate coverage, I think it's improper. And I don't think this court is authorized.
The case you rely on was an escape policy as opposed to step down where the coverage is limited to a certain amount but is available, which is the classic step down policy as opposed to escape. Isn't that right?
In the context of underinsured, I would say yes.
Where do you distinguish underinsured? How is that different other than this, the distinction you've made, first party versus third party coverage? But as far as the policy language, there's no distinction between underinsured and first party coverage and third party.
In terms of policy language, they are similar, but they are different types of insurance.
Yeah, is your argument that if the purpose is different, the purpose in the general liability sense is to protect all of the innocent people who have a right to expect that cars placed on the road by the owner of the car will carry at least the minimum compulsory coverage, if not more.
Correct.
Whereas underinsured motorist coverage is optional additional coverage that someone may choose to purchase for themselves, but it's
correct.
A little bit apples and oranges, isn't it?
They are. They are apples and oranges. They're distinct types of law. They have different purposes. While both of them get to the idea of compensating an innocent victim, the public, one has a significant body of public policy law behind it by this court, mm-hmm. beginning in 1960. In the underinsured context, it is not the same public policy statements by this court.
Tell us, why would public policy require that a third party receive more than the statutory minimum?
This court has said in Mattis that it was about certain and maximum coverage. That was words right from this court in finding coverage under a second policy greater than the policy that the driver had. In Martusis, this court said that the public policy goal that is being advanced is providing maximum coverage for the innocent victim. That is the stated public policy goal, maximum coverage for the victim.
If there was no step-down clause, that would occur even in this case, the maximum of that policy provided, but the step-down clause reduces it to the statutory minimum. And we have ruled that step-downs are appropriate and not unconstitutional as opposed to the escape clause. That's the only difference here. There's a step-down clause. If not, the full coverage is available, but under the terms of this policy, it's not.
Well, it begins by saying a customer isn't insured, so they would be covered. Then, based on the clause in the policy,
well, of course they would. Otherwise, if they weren't insured, there would be no coverage whatsoever. It has to start with that.
Actually,
premise.
No. Mattis says they're automatically an additional insured. This court has said a driver of the vehicle, unless the car is stolen, automatically.
That's a permissive use argument. That's not a policy language argument.
Correct, but whether it's in the policy or not, you're automatically
in this case, if there was no step down, it would be entitled to the full amount, but there's a legal step down which reduces it to the statutory minimum.
The language of the clause.
Can you agree with me on that? That's what that step down does?
I don't. The clause in this case reduces coverage to zero, which is what the appellate division found. And you can't have a situation where you have zero coverage.
Is your argument then that the effect of this clause is to elude? It is. You're arguing it's an escape clause. They're eluding their statutory obligation to insure the vehicle they're placing on the road.
This vehicle, the coverage in this, the clause in this case does precisely that. It results in zero coverage. The appellate division
That's because the other source of coverage filled in that statutory minimum.
That's an escape.
That's the happenstance of this case. But you're not contending that this clause excludes coverage entirely for the customer.
It excludes coverage other coverage.
It would limit it to the statutory minimum, and then if they have other coverage that provides for what the legislature says should be the coverage, then that's all that is required.
It, It excludes coverage if they have coverage that meets statutory.
Are you really arguing that is not a step down? Because had that individual had no other coverage, then that policy would have been on the hook for the $15,000, correct?
I would indicate that the policy would be on the hook for the full amount.
No, I know that's your argument, but had this played out in a different way with the individual not having other coverage, that this policy under the
if
would
they
have
had
been
no coverage
subject to statutory minimum.
If Mr. Iskateki was an uninsured driver or underinsured, he didn't have statutory minimums, right. The literal reading of the clause would result in Federated taking the position that they owe $15,000.
Right.
I would submit that's an illegal application of an escape clause in this case.
Isn't the distinction between an escape clause, which is unconstitutional, which is illegal in New Jersey, and a step down, that the step down allows for the statutory minimum coverage in accordance with what the legislature says it should be?
Yes.
Okay, so if it does that, one way or another, there's going to be a $15,000 insurance coverage here. Why isn't it a step down?
Because I don't believe in the context of liability insurance, differentiated policy limits or step downs as to the permissive user has ever been authorized by this court.
So you see this as an expansion of the use of step downs if we were to approve the appellate division. If we put it in a different context, what we're being asked to approve is, let's say an individual has a personal auto policy, and the policy has a step-down provision so that if your permissive user is a non-household member relative, say a cousin, you can impose a step-down requirement that the auto policy of the registered owner of the vehicle does not have to cover if the cousin has his or her own automobile policy that covers the minimum requirement, correct?
I didn't quite understand what the question was. But
the question is whether or not taking this argument and applying it to a personal auto policy would permit step-down coverage for different classes of individuals in the permissive driver category, like a cousin to whom you let somebody, you let drive your car.
Correct, and I don't believe that's ever been authorized by the legislature or this court, and I would tell you, you would have had cases come before you where the predominant insurance carriers of New Jersey would have had specific step-downs in the liability context. The only area where it has come up is in the underinsured context.
But you wouldn't have a contract with your cousin, presumably, maybe in some families, but there's a contract here with the customer.
The contract itself is problematic for many reasons, which I can go into.
I understand, but there's a distinction. This is the part of the analysis here is the provisions of the contract, and I understand you disagree with the way it was applied.
There's actually a provision in the Federated policy that says that the terms of the policy can't be amended by the agreement of anyone else without Federated's consent. So a rental car agreement cannot alter the terms of the insurance policy. But when you actually look at the agreement, it is problematic on so many levels for Federated to rely upon that document in this court. It's not a rental car. The car was not insured or registered as a rental car. The owner of the dealership didn't know anything about rental cars. He didn't know why it said rental car. He didn't know who drafted it. Most conspicuously, the owner of the dealership, who was the only person who would have any knowledge about the terms of that agreement, did not know that he did not provide coverage on a secondary basis to his customers. He did not know the fine print of his agreement. Mm-hmm. And the third page of his agreement, which he drafted personally, as opposed to the boilerplates 1 and 2, he wrote that your insurance is primary. And I asked him at his deposition what was his understanding of that, and he said the customer's insurance would be primary, and my insurance would step in after that and provide coverage. So I don't think saying that a victim, in this case, my client, should be bound by the boilerplate of page 2 of an agreement, which is contradicted by 3.
But they should be bound by the handwritten agreement by the owner? Not the actual policy language, but you want them to be bound by the agreement that the owner wrote?
I'm saying that agreement it can't bind my client, because honestly, the owner of the dealership didn't even understand himself what was
in that.
So
the policy void ab initio, there's no coverage, there's no dispute here, there's just no coverage available on this argument.
My point is that the rental car agreement has no impact on this case because it's not a rental car and because the dealer didn't even understand the terms.
So we go back to the terms of the policy, which has a step down. Is that what's binding?
No. What's binding is this court's statement in Mattis that the policy must provide coverage that the driver is automatically an additional insured.
If this were a basic policy as opposed to standard policy, would your argument still hold up?
Yes.
Would they be paid a difference between the basic policy, assuming they had some personal liability coverage?
Federated would probably take the position they're obligated to do that. I would not agree with their offer of that.
Tell us the facts of Mattis that you say are controlling here.
In Mattis, the driver of the car borrows a car from the husband of the insured, takes it out, goes to a number of bars, gets in an accident, causes an accident. The person who was driving the car had coverage under a policy with Allstate that gave them coverage for when you are in not only your own car, but a car you might occasionally use. So she had a policy with Allstate. There was a trial, I guess. There's a judgment of $25,000 entered. Allstate paid the $10,000, and the question before this court was whether she was entitled to coverage under the Nationwide policy for the vehicle she borrowed. And the court dealt with the question of what level of coverage are we going to adopt in terms of extending coverage to permissive users. As of 1960, there was a debate in New Jersey of whether to adopt the broadest form of the initial permission rule, to adopt a or one of two variations that dealt with whether someone deviated from the permission.
But that's a completely different subject.
Correct.
And all those cases are not really going to address this issue. Even
correct.
Willis, all those cases are dealing with whether or not the person falls within the category of a permissive user.
Correct.
None of them are dealing with step-downs. So that's why I'm asking you that.
But
the facts of Mattis, if the Nationwide policy had different categories of permissive users, then we might be closer to this case. But that's not the case.
The case,
and that's true of Willis too. Willis, and all the other cases you're citing to, are merely determining whether or not a person fits within the category of permissive user. Correct?
No. Right. Willis had an exclusion. If the customer has their own insurance, we don't provide coverage. That's this. It's very similar to this case.
And what were you going to add about the Mattis case?
In Mattis, so the Justice Salvin is correct. A lot of the decision is about which one of the permissive user rules for the court to adopt. The court adopted the broadest initial permission rule, which says other than theft, you are covered. But what's significant is it says a person other than a car thief is automatically an additional insured. And this court has extended that to say any attempt to eliminate that is void. In Willis, the carrier, which was kind of the first round, there was a couple cases like Zula where they started to write in permission clauses, and the court said, we're not going to get into litigating the scope of permission. In Willis, they wrote a clause in to say, we don't cover the permissive user if they have their own insurance. That is this case.
But Willis, Aubrey's followed Willis. Willis is...
No.
In time. Willis is 1968 or something.
69. 68 Chancery Division, 69.
Okay, 69. And Aubrey is mid-90s, if I remember correctly.
Correct.
So why doesn't Willis trump Aubrey?
Aubrey doesn't cite Willis.
Aubrey
does not cite Mattis.
I understand that. But
so
my point is that your argument, as I understand it, would suggest that Willis, having set a broad permissive user rule, would essentially trample right over limitations in policies that it would affect the coverage of the permissive user.
I think
it seems to me, and I understand that one doesn't, I was just checking to see if I was correct about my recollection, Aubrey doesn't cite Willis. Aubrey doesn't seem to think it has an issue with Willis. Why wouldn't Willis, under your theory, require Aubrey to come out the opposite way?
Because Aubrey is asking the question of whether the driver is entitled to underinsured benefits in that case.
But the driver is a permissive user in Aubrey.
Correct.
So why, I think what you're arguing is that whatever limitations are in the insurance agreement would not apply because that would undermine Willis.
Yes.
And so why doesn't Aubrey undermine, if a Supreme Court case can undermine a Chancery Division, Appellate Division case, why doesn't Aubrey undermine Willis?
Well, Willis was actually affirmed by this court, OB.
I understand.
Short opinion.
Yeah, I understand.
But they're asking different questions. It's not about undermining one.
Okay, so why aren't there different questions in our case?
Because Aubrey is an underinsured case.
Our case is not, the Appellate Division in our case is not saying we're limiting permissive users. It's analyzing the clause to see if it's a step down or is it an exclusion that would not be legal. So that's what Aubrey does. Why does Willis even enter into the picture?
Because the Willis is analyzing it from the context of liability insurance and the victim in a liability case. Aubrey is analyzing it from the context of an underinsured plaintiff seeking
understand.
Coverage
you're making
under
a different distinction. You're distinguishing it on a different basis, but neither of those, they're both permissive user cases. And your argument has been from when you started, and is in your brief as well, is very focused on permissive user is the answer here. So my question is, permissive user, if that's true, ought to have made Aubrey come out the other way.
Not necessarily. It's just permissive user is not an underinsured.
Are you suggesting the public policy providing coverage for innocent victims is different for third party or first party? Is it the public policy the same whether it's an innocent victim first party or an innocent victim third party that they should provide the maximum coverage? You're suggesting that the public policy is different depending on whether it's first party or third party, and how do what language in the statute? What language in public policy do you? There are
different public policies behind liability exclusions and underinsured exclusions. And this court, and probably more so in the appellate division, has said that
liability exclusions, the issue is not liability. If there's no liability, there's no coverage, no damage. The issue is protection of the victims by insurance. And there's no difference, as I can tell from any statute, whether it's the policyholder or someone else. They're both entitled to maximum coverage and protection. And so the distinction you're making, I'd like to know where you derive that distinction from.
There has been a recognition, especially in the appellate division, of things that are enforceable in terms of first-party insurance, UIM and PIP exclusions, are not enforceable in the liability context because they violate public policy. And you can go back, I think it's in the kind of the mid-1980s where there's a recognition that in the underinsured context, as opposed to uninsured, which is just 15, but in the underinsured context, that short of a specific contradiction to the statute, that it is a matter of contract.
Well,
it is freedom of contract.
Underinsured is not required.
Correct.
That's as opposed to uninsured, but the liability policy for vehicles is required for all.
Correct.
So it would fall under that coverage. The distinction you're making, underinsured is different because you can elect not to purchase underinsured, or the amount you purchase can be different.
Correct.
That's the distinction, not the first party, third party, isn't it?
Well, that is the first party, third party distinction. And as a result, because it's optional insurance, the courts have said that short of a contradiction to the specific provisions of the statute, insurance companies and their insureds are granted great leeway in the context of underinsured coverage to put limitations they want in those policies. But in the liability context, you can't, because liability is required.
Is there another issue that you wanted to address? We're reaching the end of your time.
I'm sorry. There is. Even to the extent that you don't necessarily accept my argument on the scope of the permissive user rule, you could find coverage exists in this case on other grounds. There is a regulation that required this dealer to provide coverage for all users of the vehicle, period. All users. That language has been ignored at both the trial court and the appellate division, quite honestly. The regulation on its face is clear.
What does coverage mean in that context? Does it mean 15,000? Does it mean 10 million? What does it mean?
It says maintain liability insurance for all users of all vehicles.
And they didn't do that.
By their interpretation, they have no liability insurance.
their interpretation based on the way that the 15,000 plays against the existing coverage. But this policy, in another situation where there was no other coverage, would have insured that driver, right? Correct?
If there was zero coverage, they would take the position they owe 15, despite the fact the regulation requires even higher limits than that. And the...
What's the limit of what is required?
As a licensed car dealer, Hunterdon has an obligation to provide a minimum of $100,000 for all users of all vehicles. And as part of that licensing process, they submitted a certificate of insurance to the state that said they had $510 million. They did not indicate in that filing with the Motor Vehicle Commission in order to get their license that they, in fact, were not covering all users for all vehicles.
No, but it said subject to exclusions and all those other things when they registered. Yes?
The boilerplate language of the certificate says subject to exclusions. The interesting thing about that is the exclusion would swallow the policy because the intended user of these vehicles are the customers.
Okay, so this is my last question to you. You're not looking for 15,000. You're looking for the full coverage.
Right.
So tell us the public policy reason that bars the dealership from treating its own employees differently from people who are loaning or borrowing the car and having two different limits of coverage. What is the public policy reason that under our law that makes that illegal?
The public policy, in my reading of all these cases, looks at it from the context of the innocent victim. And in this case, the vehicle, by your Honor's question, could be driven in and out of coverage of whether it was driven by an employee or a customer. I don't think that goes to the heart of the permissive user rule. The idea is to protect the victim based upon their being struck by this car causing the accident, and this court saying that coverage should cover all users, they're automatically an additional insured.
Would you like to briefly address the umbrella policy?
The issue of application to the umbrella is the same question. They have an exclusion in the policy that says we exclude customers. I would say that violates Mattis and the subsequent cases, which say you have to be an automatically an additional insured. The two cases that have addressed the issue of umbrellas or excess in the context of liability policies by this court is Martusis and Gazis. Martusis was a permissive user rule case. Father insured the vehicle, gave it to his son, gave it to his friend, caused a fatality. And the question was whether this court would extend the permissive user rule and find that secondary driver, which the court has previously found in primary policies, the case being Odalecki in 1970, that doesn't matter who you give the keys to, as the keys get passed down the chain, as long as it wasn't stolen, coverage extends. This court took that rule and said, we're going to extend that rule into the excess case. And the court specifically did it for the purpose of recognizing the public policy extends to the umbrella. The court said, and I'll quote, at the root of the permissive user rule is to ensure the collectability of damages wrongfully inflicted in the operation of motor vehicles. And the court said it wasn't based on the risk to the insured. This is an important point. The court said we're not looking at this from the context of these permissive user rules were never about analyzing the risk to Hunterdon Motors. Because in all of these cases, the insured was not the exposed party when the case got to the court. There wasn't an agency. The question isn't analyzed from the liability, it's analyzed from the side of protecting the victim. And so the court said, we have no problem extending permissive user rule to an umbrella, irregardless of the fact that the owner of that vehicle had no liability exposure. His carrier should provide coverage to that innocent victim. And this court restated that excess policy rule, the application in Justice LaVecchia's decision in Gazis versus Miller, which dealt with the issue of whether in the context of a secondary policy, I believe it involved a diocese vehicle, there was a $250,000 primary and a $750,000 excess, and it had a notice provision of whether the insured had to notify the carrier of a potential claim. And this court adopted the appreciable prejudice rule, which made sense from a simple standpoint, but the court specifically said it's because of the strong public policy of spreading risks of protecting innocent victims, and this approach extends regardless of the label that you put on the top of the policy. It doesn't matter. It's an auto policy, which it is in this case. This is not a broad umbrella policy. I know there's been some arguments in the brief below to cite to the White's case or the Seifel case. Those cases are umbrella cases. This case, the policies here, call them whatever you want. It's an auto policy and an auto excess policy. It doesn't sit atop.
Your basic, tell me if I'm mistaken, your basic argument is that step-downs are just contrary to public policy, period.
As to a permissive user, yes.
Okay.
I have just one question. I inferred from your papers, and you, I think, briefly touched on it here, there's a difference between what the dealership is statutorily required to have in terms of third-party coverage and what our no-fault statute requires, the minimum mandatory coverage. There's a difference.
Yes.
And weren't you arguing that that conflict, based on public policy considerations, should be resolved in favor of the statutorily required limits for automobile dealerships?
There is a conflict in terms of the dollar amount of the limits. The statute under Title 39 doesn't refer to the permissive user when you read the statute,
right,
but this court has said it automatically extends to them. The regulation essentially takes permissive user language into the regulation because it says all vehicles, all users, that is the permissive user, has higher limits.
And is your argument that that's what should control our decision, should have controlled the appellate division's decision, not the minimum mandatory limits under our motor vehicle insurance law?
At least, yes. I don't think there's any interpretation when you start looking at coverage limits. I don't believe you can ever end up at zero as the appellate division did. I believe that clearly violates case law. I don't think you can end up at 15, because if you end up at a 15,000, you're rewriting the policy, because there is no interpretation of this policy that results in 15 under the facts of this case, which also violates the law and the decisions of this court, Proformance and Potent Zone, about when you're writing a legal clause into a policy. There's no interpretation of the insurance policy that results in 100, because Federated and 100 never cited it, which gets into the remedy question, which is a question of Proformance and Potent Zone. But the regulation is higher, no doubt, and that regulation was adopted by the Motor Vehicle Commission as a statement of public policy. In the comments, they said, we think this cost or risk should be borne by these dealers.
But you're not arguing for 100.
No, I'm not. But it,
and
but
you haven't raised that as an argument.
My point is,
wrong about that?
There is no interpretation of the insurance policy under the facts of this case where you can decide at zero based on case law, 15 based on a reading of the policy, 100 based on a reading of the policy. And that goes back to this court's decision in Potent Zone. When an insurance company knowingly writes improper clauses into a policy.
But let me just see if I understand. As to the second, I understand about the zero, and I understand about the 100,000. But as to the second, you're saying that the 15 may be there, but as a matter of how it went in this case, because there was other insurance, that 15 is not going to be paid by that insurer. Am I right about that? The other insurer pays the 15.
Well, you'd be entitled to both under an
understand, under but mass. when you say that you can't end up at 15,
you can't.
In some cases you would end up at 15. It's just that by operation of the way the two policies interact with one another, in this case it wouldn't.
Correct.
So that's not in this case. So what's, why is that a legal provision when in another situation had the motorist had no coverage, that 15 would have been paid?
I think you have to apply it to the facts before you. I mean, the insurance company wrote a clause that would require this court to rewrite it, the literal reading. And this court has always said, you don't rewrite policies for the benefit of insurance companies when they come before you. You would have to rewrite the wording of that clause to reach a zero, a 15, or a 100 without question. There's, because none of those numbers are in the policy.
But aren't step-downs, and I understand you're making a distinction between the Aubrey situation and this, but aren't step-downs always about providing the mandatory minimum, and that doesn't necessarily get paid by that insurer because of the way there may be other coverage. but the insurer has to at least provide that if it is necessary because there's no other coverage. That's a step, isn't that right about that's a step down?
Correct.
So you're saying that if there is a provision that could be read as a step down, we should just reject it as the operative provision because in this case it would end up at zero? Is that what, that would make the whole step down concept go out the window, would it not?
I don't think you can have a step down as to a permissive user for just liability as a matter of law.
I think we understand your position, and we're going to have you back
for
rebuttal. Mr. Foley.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Mr. Keneally and I part company on the issue of the step down. I don't believe that it is necessary for this court to decide this case and reach an issue as to whether step-downs are per se invalid under the terms of the laws of New Jersey. But interpreting the terms of this policy, I think this court should be mindful of the fact that the policy in this case contains something which the policy in Aubrey did not contain.
Can I pause you there? Is it your position representing New Jersey manufacturers that step-downs are permissible for permissive users?
So long as they don't step it down below the statutorily required minimum coverages.
Okay.
There is, however, a distinction in this case that I'll get to in a moment. But in this case, unlike the policy in Aubrey, there is a step down provision in the uninsured and underinsured motorist endorsement to this policy. There was no such endorsement in the Aubrey case. And the Aubrey case was decided basically on two bases. First, on the definition of what constitutes an underinsured motor vehicle and how you determine that, by which policy limits do you compare. The Aubrey court found that you compare the limits of the policy held personally by the customer in that case versus the limits held by the tortfeasor in that case. And in that case, because the combined limits of the tortfeasors exceeded the underinsured motorist limits of Mrs. Aubrey, the court found by definition the tortfeasor's vehicle was not an underinsured motor vehicle. It went on, and I would submit unnecessarily went on, to discuss the parity provision in the underinsured motorist statute. That is, that an insurer, because underinsured motorist coverage is optional, because uninsured motorist coverage in excess of $15,000 is optional, an insurer is obligated to provide an option for underinsured motorist coverage and additional uninsured motorist coverage to a certain class of insureds under the policy, that being the named insured and resident relatives in the household. Because that optional coverage was involved, the parity provision of the statute, I would submit to you, was not necessary to reach. It wasn't necessary for the court to then compare the liability provisions of the garage keeper's policy in Aubrey and come to the conclusion, because they didn't provide any coverage under those provisions, that there was no underinsured motorist coverage.
What do you think the purpose was in enacting that regulation that required not coverage for the dealership in statutory minimum amounts, but in the amounts that the regulation required?
I think, and I did not look at the legislative history of it, but I think it was recognizing the potentially greater risks of drivers who are borrowing other drivers' vehicles. I mean, it's not this is not the only instances which occurs. In fact, if you look at the statutory scheme now for rideshare vehicles, the Ubers and the Lyfts and so forth, the statute under Title 39 regarding the insurance coverage requirements on those vehicles.
That's different from here.
It is.
The companies that make a business out of renting vehicles for people to use or transport, not this situation where it's a loaner at a garage, so to speak.
Well, that's correct.
It's a different statute.
It is different, but I'm just addressing the reason why I believe that the regulation requires greater than 1530 for a vehicle owned by a dealership which is being loaned to its customers.
Right.
So in this instance, in this case, in the policy that Federated issued here, there is a step down. There's a specific step down clause in the uninsured and underinsured motorist endorsement. So Federated clearly knows how to write a step down clause. And that is what this court has considered in other cases, the Pinto case and so forth, regarding the limits of coverage.
For underinsured motorist coverage.
Underinsured and underinsured motorist coverage. And those are the classes where the named insured, if you're not the named insured under the policy for which you're seeking coverage, but you are a named insured under another policy, the coverage steps down to the coverage that you have available under your own policy. Correct.
But how does that apply then to general liability coverage?
Because the clause in this case is not provided in where most step downs are found in, where you talk about the limits of coverage. This is found in the definition of who is an insured under the terms of that policy. And the definition of who is an insured starts off by saying your customers are not insureds. That clearly is an illegal escape clause. You cannot say your customers are not insured under the terms of the policy. And this clause in this case then provides two exceptions to that exclusion of coverage. The first exception is for someone who has no coverage at all. They get 15 under the terms of the policy. The second exclusion is, or the second exception to the exclusion, is for customers who have less than $15,000, and then they bump it up to $15,000. But in the context of this case, where Mr. Uscatecki did not fit either one of those exceptions because he had coverage in excess of the statutory minimum, he remains completely excluded from coverage under the terms of the policy, and I would submit that that is an illegal escape clause excluding him from coverage.
When would that latter clause, the second of the exceptions, kick in if you're dealing with a New Jersey customer with New Jersey insurance? They'd be obliged to have the statutory minimum.
Well, I guess I could conceive of situations in which you could argue that because there are multiple claimants. So, for example, if you have six claimants under a 1530 policy and they prorate the limits, everybody only gets $5,000 apiece, it's possible that under those circumstances it might kick in. But I would agree that that's generally going to be a limited circumstance. But one of the other things that the Aubrey Court did is, in reaching its decision, the Aubrey Court endorsed the Appellate Division's finding in the Rao case. And the Rao, I don't always get the pronunciation right, excised from the policy, found in the policy's language in the insuring agreement, struck from the policy a parenthetical phrase when talking about the limits of the coverage. And there, the language, and I've quoted it on page 9 of my brief, but the language read, the portion of the limit applicable to persons or organizations required to by law to be an insured is only the amount. And then there's a parenthetical that says, or amount in excess of any other insurance available to them needed to comply with the minimum limits provision of such law in the jurisdiction where the occurrence takes place.
Is that the part of Rao, and I'm just looking for it now, but is that the part of Rao that is cited in Aubrey? I thought it was a different aspect of Rao that was cited in Aubrey.
In
that
step
down discussion.
I believe that they endorsed the overall principle in Rao. I think that what happened was, in Rao, when the court struck the parenthetical phrase, when the court said that it was an illegal clause to say or amount in excess of any other insurance available to them, you wound up with the decision that once you took that language out, it said that the insurer in that case was required to provide the statutory minimum. And that was the statutory minimum which was required regardless of any other insurance that was available. So in effect what it was saying is that coverage would stack on top of any other available liability insurance. But it's relevant, I think, in the context of this case because of the question Justice Rabner, that you asked earlier about, well, if we invalidate this clause, do we just step back to the minimum statutory limits and get you to $15,000? And I would submit that you do not, because once you strike the illegal escape clause in this case, there is no fallback language as there was in Rao. There is no basis to say, well, when we strike the illegal language of the policy, it leaves us with other language in the policy which gives you the step down. But and you don't have that in this case.
Go ahead.
You actually need that language? Isn't the language of policy clear that if it were to be struck down as an illegal escape clause, not a step down, that what would be available would be the statutory minimum, which is 15? Does it require any language to say, no, you get the entire amount?
There's no, that would not apply to Mr. Özgetekin in this case, because, as I said, this is an exclusion of coverage for customers.
So
there are exceptions to the exclusion.
Under your interpretation, then, you would match whatever that coverage is for the individual?
Once you...
So somebody had a $1 million policy, it would be that. Somebody had that $25,000 single limit, it would be that. So that the policy would track whatever is that?
The policy, once you write the exclusion out, once you take the exclusion out of the policy, and there is no fallback step down under the policy, then the only thing left is the full limits of the policy.
So where you differ from your colleague is that if this was written differently and there had been an express step down for liability coverage to the mandatory minimum amounts, you feel that that would be acceptable? Am I misunderstanding?
Setting aside the question of the regulation and the requirement from the Motor Vehicle Commission on what you need to do to license for
No, answer it with that. If you think the regulation requires them to go above the statutory minimum, then tell me. Do they?
I would submit that it does, but...
So you read the regulation as a conflict, if you will, that wins out over 396B-1.
Well, I would submit that 396B-1 sets minimums. Mm-hmm. Obviously, this Court has always found that you can't undercut the minimum coverage. I believe that you can provide greater than the minimums.
And as I understand your argument, I have been wondering about this. Is this case all about a conflict between the requirements of coverage under the regulation versus 6B-1? And I think what you're saying is you see it the same way.
The way that I see it is there's a distinction between the licensing requirement for the dealership and the insuring requirement for the general public. In other words, in order to maintain that dealership license,
Understood.
You must meet this requirement. That's
Understood.
Separate
and $100,000. That's $100,000.
That's correct.
Yes.
And which wins, and
yes.
How do you get there? Which limit wins, and how do you get there?
Well,
thank you for bringing that up. Just a little. Yeah, I tried to do
you're welcome.
That.
I mean, that's what I'm wondering. That
sure.
Otherwise, the filing that has been made with the Motor Vehicle Commission is illusory.
I think you're going to hear that from amicus, but I would agree with that. I would submit, however, that you don't get to that once you read the clause in this case in the definition of who is an insured as an exclusion of coverage. And because that's an illegal avoidance of the statutory requirement of coverage,
mm-hmm.
Once you read that out and strike that from the policy, you are left with no other step-down provision there, and you get the full limits.
Are you suggesting that all they had to do was, like, write the policy this way? Insured, number one, all of our employees and agents, they have $500,000. Insured, number two, are people who are loaners of our cars, and they get 3015. Would that be okay?
Subject again to the regulation.
Well, I thought you said no. The regulation
yeah.
trumps.
Correct. That's right. That would.
So then you're saying that there's no way to rewrite that particular policy, as Justice Lepecki is suggesting,
mm-hmm.
and now what you seem to be submitting. It's that the regulation requires the dealership to offer the same coverage to its employees as to those people who are borrowing cars. Is that what you're arguing?
Is that the way the NJ policies are written?
Excuse me?
Is that the way the NJM policies are written?
NJM
first answer my question, then get to Justice Fernandez's feelings. Go ahead.
I guess I just keep coming back to, we don't reach the regulation when you strike the clause from the policy.
I'm asking you, what is your view of the regulation? Is your view of the regulation require the dealership to offer the same coverage limits to its employees as to those who are loaning the car or borrowing the car?
I would submit that it does.
Okay.
Sure.
Thank you. Now, answer Justice Fernandez.
What you've been suggesting to the court, is that the way your company's policies are written? If I were to get a specimen, a sample policy right now?
Your specimen policy, I'm trying to remember the terms of the general automobile policies of NJM, and the step-downs are contained in the limits of coverage provisions. They're not, and there are certain definitional provisions, and the first one that comes to my mind is the loading and unloading provision, because that comes into the definition of what I use.
We don't have loading or unloading.
Your client's step-downs apply to permissive users?
Not in the definition of who is an insured in the liability coverages of the policy. As I recall it, I don't have a copy of those policies in front of me. But
I'm sorry to rush you along. Is there any other argument? And you can only give us a clipped version of it. We only have a couple more moments.
Okay, then I would submit that you do in this case, just because of the way the policies are written and ambiguities in policies are construed against insurers. It happens to me all of the time. If you look at the uninsured, underinsured motorist endorsement in this case, you will find that for a person who has no insurance available to him or her from any source, if you follow the language of the UMUIM endorsement in this case, that person will be entitled to $50,000 underinsured motorist coverage under the terms of this policy, despite what the interpretation of the what's being called the step down in this case.
So what do you think the coverage is in this case?
The full amount of the $500,000 garage keeper's policy. I haven't taken any positions with respect to the umbrella policy or the simply addressing the garage keeper's policy.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Salzberg.
Good morning. It is, as always, a great privilege to be here today, and particularly today to discuss with the court very briefly the central problem that NJAJ finds most or particularly troublesome in this case, and that we think this court likewise should find particularly troublesome, and that is that the policies that Federated issued to Hunter and BMW in this case contained limitations and exclusions that rendered those policies non-compliant with the Commissioner of Motor Vehicles Regulation, NJAC 13:21-15.2L. Federated opposes NJAJ's position in this case by saying, well, as an initial matter, the commissioner simply didn't have authority to write that regulation. And that's because the licensing statute doesn't contain a specific and express reference to liability insurance. And therefore, it was beyond the authority of the commissioner to write the regulation in the first place. And while it is true that there isn't a specific and express reference to insurance, there is a general legislative mandate that this court recognized in the All-Stars Auto Group case as follows, quote, the legislature tasked the administrator and deputy administrator of the commission, discussing the commissioner of motor vehicles, with various duties, including the improvement of the safety and security of the state's motor vehicle licensing, registration, titling, and inspection system. Now, certainly a broad mandate like that reasonably includes the authority on the part of the commissioner to require minimum liability insurance to be carried as a condition of getting a license. But even in the absence of that broad mandate, it should strike us as exceedingly odd that the Commissioner of Motor Vehicles is without power and authority to conclude that motor vehicles that are owned by dealerships and driven by permissive users create a greater risk to the driving public than automobiles that are driven for private use, and that therefore, as a condition to licensing of a motor vehicle dealership, the dealership has to carry certain higher minimum limits of liability. It's not like the Commissioner of Motor Vehicles is attempting to regulate heart valve transplants. Nobody in this case has suggested that the Commissioner has done something arbitrary and capricious, and on this record, such an argument could be made in any event. The second reason, general reason, that Federated opposes NJAJ's position in this case is because Federated says that neither Federated nor Hunterdon made any misrepresentations to the commissioner when they submitted the certificates of insurance to the commissioner, and therefore the doctrine of regulatory estoppel, which we believe applies to this case, according to Federated, doesn't apply. Well, there are two different ways to make a misrepresentation. One is an affirmative declarative misrepresentation, such as representing that X is true when in fact not X is true. The other way to make a misrepresentation is by omission. And when Federated and Hunterdon submitted the certificates of insurance in this case to the commissioner under that regulation, 13:21-15.2L, when they submitted their certificates of insurance to the commissioner, they were doing so under that regulation, and that regulation led the commissioner to believe that that insurance, the certificated insurance, provided $500,000 in primary insurance and $10 million in umbrella insurance, and that it did so under the regulation as to all of the vehicles owned by the dealership and as to all permissive users. And I submit to the court that if Federated and or Hunterdon had represented to the commissioner that, well, I know that the certificate of insurance says 500 and then 10 million. However, these policies have provisions in them that on the one hand will limit certain permissive users to only $15,000 and not the statutory minimum and not the 500,000 that we've represented that they have, but to certain permissive users, they only get 15,000. And to all permissive users, they don't get any part of the 10 million. If that omission had not been made, if instead Federated had represented to the commissioner,
The vehicle company say that the insurer is subject to terms and exclusions and limits of all such policies.
Certainly does.
Basically, you're surmising this. It's speculation. You don't know what the commission would have done based on that.
I believe, I am surmising, but I think it's more than a reasonable surmise that when the regulation requires that all vehicles and all permissive users must be insured to a minimum of $100,000 or up to $250,000 for death and bodily injury, when that regulation requires that minimum coverage and an insurance company submits under that regulation a document to the commissioner that says, we provide this level of coverage under this regulation to all permissive users. If the commissioner had known that that coverage was in fact not available and in fact the minimums were not available to all permissive users, I submit to the court that the commissioner would very likely and almost certainly not have issued the license.
Is your point simply that a step down can't be valid if it goes below the coverage the regulation requires?
Correct.
And how do you respond to an argument that the regulation elevates the minimum coverage beyond what the statute does?
because the commissioner has, I submit that the commissioner of motor vehicles has the authority to make a conclusion that auto dealerships ought to have and need to have more coverage because of the risks, the additional risks. And in fact, the commissioner has made public statements, and they're in our brief and in the legislative history. The commissioner has made public statements to that effect, that dealership cars, loaner cars, present a greater risk to the public and the public safety, and for that reason, I, the commissioner, am requiring that dealerships provide liability coverage in excess of what the
You're arguing that the regulation bars an insurance company from discriminating among permissive users?
Correct.
And are you extending that argument to the umbrella policy as well?
I am. And the reason that I'm extending it to the umbrella policy in this case is because the representation that was made to the commissioner was that all permissive users would have $500,000 in primary and $10 million in umbrella. And under this court's establishment of the regulatory estoppel doctrine from Morton International, I think that that those representations to the commissioner give all of the insureds who are potentially covered under those policies the reasonable expectation that that coverage will apply.
But the representation had a very major caveat, and that is subject to the exclusions in the policy, correct?
Correct.
So the commissioner then, if the commissioner is confronted with representation subject to exclusions in the policy, why can't the commissioner, constantly dealing with insureds, say, well, tell me what those are?
I suppose that the commissioner could, other than, and I'm speculating here, other than the limited resources that the commissioner may have to do that.
I understand, but isn't that a pretty normal thing for insureds to do, and that is to limit their representation by whatever their policy says? I'm wondering if that isn't just something that's done all the time by insureds.
It very well may be something that's done all the time.
And you're saying that is there for all insureds, they can't disclaim or exclude within that representation?
Not when the exclusion or the limitation results in providing insurance that is below the regulatory minimums.
Are there regulations for other types of insureds other than the car dealerships that we're talking about here? And I'm asking this to, if we were to accept your principle, would we be essentially affecting other types of insureds?
I wish that I were prepared to answer that question today by having done a survey of all of the different kinds of regulations that might apply in this kind of context.
Because you're going back to the Chief's question, you're saying this regulation trumps, or this regulation basically adds an additional requirement that the statute, the legislature, has not imposed.
This regulation has added an additional requirement for licensing of automobile dealerships that the statute doesn't impose. That's correct.
Is there any law out there where you have a regulation? I mean, obviously, we're all very familiar with these statutory requirements, 15,000 right, in this case. But is there any law out there when the commissioner has issued a regulation that would essentially expand that requirement beyond the point where the legislature has not reached?
I don't know the answer to that question, Your Honor. I can say, however, that when you have a statutory minimum, and I get back to what my colleague argued a little earlier, is that the statutory minimum of $15,000 is just that, a minimum, and that additional coverage over and above that minimum can be established by law, by the court, by commissioners, by administrative agencies. And what's been done here is that an administrative agency has in fact concluded that the risk imposed on the driving public by dealership borrowed cars is sufficient to require an additional amount of coverage. And the representations that were made by Federated here omitted the fact that that certificate in fact didn't tell the whole story, and that they didn't comply with the minimums.
Understood. So just help us with this point. 39.6B speaks to the requirements for registered owners of cars. The regulation, of course, addresses dealers. What's the enabling authority if you can point us to it, for the height, for the regulation relating to dealers.
Well, I think that the only enabling authority from the legislation that I can point to is the general language that I pointed to, for, that Your Honor, that the court cited in the All Stars Auto Group case, and that is a broad regulatory mandate that the commissioner is charged with addressing the safety in connection with licensing of dealerships.
I'm sorry, I
was just going to say, other than that, again, it would seem odd to me, and I think should seem odd to the court, that the Commissioner of Motor Vehicles would not have the authority to mandate additional levels of insurance for dealerships once the commissioner had made a finding that there was a particular kind of risk that
and all stars
that required
that. And all stars, then we said the commissioner overstepped her
yes.
authority?
Yes, that's
true.
Would
the commissioner have the authority to say that looking at New Jersey, people have long commutes, those people with commutes in excess of 60 miles an hour round trip every day pose a greater risk because they're on the road more. So, very nice legislature, 15,000 works for your average person, perhaps, but these long commuters, defined as X, must have higher limits.
I guess I'm on a slippery slope here, I understand.
Well, so potentially are we.
I understand that as well.
So
well,
what's,
is there
what,
a challenge to the regulation in this action?
Okay, can I just finish?
Okay.
Can you just finish?
Sure.
Would that be beyond the authority of the commissioner?
I think if I were sitting in Your Honor's chair, I might be able to come up with a reason why it would potentially be overstepping the commissioner's authority, because in that case, you have a statutory mandate that is addressed specifically to that class and category of driver without distinction of the fact that they're driving 20 miles versus 60 miles, whereas in this case, you have the distinction, in my view, is that auto dealerships, and the commissioner has made a finding, that auto dealerships, as opposed to privately driven, automobiles driven for private use, auto dealerships in their commercial capacity pose an inherently greater risk to the driving public, and I think that distinction is there.
I'm sorry. The statutes apply to policies issued to auto dealerships.
They do.
So it's not that the legislature's made any distinction.
That's right. The commissioner has made that distinction, and I think it's a rational distinction. And to the extent that distinction has to be made in order to apply the additional minimums in this case. That distinction is rational. It's a rational distinction that the commissioner has made based upon its administrative judgment, and I think that it's a decision that can be made by the commissioner. However, again, that's not something that is necessarily required of this court to find in order to apply the regulatory estoppel doctrine.
Do you know whether there are regulations in other areas that set a minimum level of malpractice insurance for people in different professions?
In particular, kinds of doctors with specialties?
That's one. It could be anything, accountants, nurses, or whatever.
I don't know the answer, Your Honor.
Anything you'd like to add?
No, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Aylward.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me state at the outset what a privilege to be here before this court in New Jersey. I may wish your weather was a little bit warmer than Boston today. At the very outset, isn't it equally odd that the Motor Vehicle Commission adopts regulations purporting to supersede 39.6B without referencing 39.6B, and that it's the Motor Vehicle Commission and not the Department of Banking and Insurance that does this? You would think if that was the intent, it would be evident. This is a case, it's not a case about permissive use. To listen to my brothers in their presentations this morning, you would have thought that the issue was the scope of Willits and Madison permissive use. We have never contested that Mr. Uskoteki was a permissive user. The car was loaned to him pursuant to a written agreement. The issue is whether this language is a valid step-down clause or an illegal escape clause. And the key distinction is whether the term in question merely limits coverage or excludes it. There are numerous cases in which this court has found that there are illegal escape clauses because the policy excludes all coverage for customers, all coverage for family members. This language, which is identical to the language in the Harleysville policy that this court considered in Aubrey, does not do that. It provides coverage for customers under some circumstances. It does not provide coverage under other circumstances. It limits the coverage. The fact that that may therefore have an exclusive effect does not render it an illegal escape clause. What my brother would have this court do is declare that all step-down clauses in liability policies are per se illegal, number one. And number two, that in any case involving a permissive user, there should be coverage up to the full policy limits without regard to what the statutes or applicable administrative regulations may require. And that's simply not the law of New Jersey. In New Jersey, a policy term should be enforced if it is clearly written and not against public policy. In 1995, this court ruled in Aubrey versus Harleysville that a step-down clause that was letter for letter identical to what's contained in the federated policy was a valid enforceable step-down clause. And this court further found that it was not invalid as being against the public policy of New Jersey. It meets the standard, therefore, for being enforceable. Now, the argument is made that this is, that Aubrey was a UIM case and that the cases relying on it are UIM cases. Well, that's not true. In finding, in reaching its final analysis in Aubrey, this court interpreted not the step-down provisions in the Harleysville policy, but the step-down provisions in the liability provisions of the auto policy there, because that was necessary to determine the amount of UIM coverage. So what this court found in Aubrey was the step-down language, and interpreted in Aubrey, was the step-down language in the liability provisions. Yes, in the context of UIM, but as the appellate division ruled in Catanzaro, the ultimate effect of Aubrey is to limit UIM coverage in the case. That result was dependent on the finding that the liability step-down language was valid. So what you are being asked to do today is to scrap Aubrey, to reject a precedent that's been on the books for 23 years, that this court has relied on in several cases, and that, by my last count, two dozen rulings of the appellate division have relied on, and instead jump into the abyss based on a not very clear administrative regulation from the Motor Vehicle Commission that doesn't specifically talk about it doesn't seem to be directed at insurance generally, is more in terms of public safety and licensing provisions. Now, we can only surmise why the Motor Vehicle Commission adopted this regulation, but if you look at the quotes from the drafting history, the regulatory history that were in the amicus brief and in Gracia's brief, the issue seems to have been dealer plates. Now, the car that Uzgatecki was driving was not a car with dealer plates. It was a regularly registered, licensed car in New Jersey with regular New Jersey license plates on it. We can speculate what the issues are with dealer plates, but the commissioner seemed to be concerned that there was a plague of dealer plates letting loose people on the road who weren't properly registered and may have created a greater risk than is normally the case. It may well be in those circumstances that the court felt that there was a greater need for insurance for certain kinds of vehicles, certain kinds of operations. But the point is, it doesn't apply in this context. It's also troubling, as I stated at the outset, that you have the commission adopting a regulation that in effect would supersede the general rule created by the legislature without even referencing that. I mean, we start with the question of whether the commissioner has the authority to do that, or whether it's proper for the MVC to be doing it instead of the Department of Banking and Insurance. But more fundamentally, even without citing 39.6B, how is it that this new regulation by the Motor Vehicle Commission for Public Safety supersedes the 1530 requirements in Title 39, Section 6B.
How is it superseding it if 6B is merely a minimum and the MVC reg on its face appears to require a higher level?
Well, it doesn't say that. 39.6B says that you can buy insurance, you must buy 1530. It doesn't then give the authority to administrative commissions to adopt higher regulations. And there's no indication that this regulation was intended to apply.
Did you challenge the regulation?
No.
So what's the import of the regulation?
I think it's a red herring, Your Honor. I don't think it's meant to address this situation at all.
But tell us why, looking at the language of the regulation that says dealers must demonstrate liability insurance for all vehicles owned or operated at their consent.
And the point is, there was nothing that Federated did that is contrary to that. But this is entirely different from the issue you had in Morton versus Schemmel accident. There was an affirmative representation about the meaning of the word sudden that was inconsistent with the issue that insurers were later litigating in terms of the meaning of the word sudden. Here, Federated attested to the fact that, truthfully, the two policies that they issued to Hunterton BMW had aggregate limits of $500,000 and $10 million. Now, it also had boilerplate language, which you will find in every certificate of insurance issued in this state, that says that this is not insurance itself, it is evidence of it, and it's subject to the terms, conditions, limitations, exclusions in the policy. An insurance certificate is a one-page document. It's not an insurance policy. Insurance policies are complex instruments with a lot of different pages and provisions. Surely, if the Motor Vehicle Commission was confused about that, they would have asked for a copy of the policy, would have asked, what are these conditions, limitations, exclusions that you're referring to? And yet there is no evidence in the record that any of that happened.
Is it your position that the plain language, assume the regulation applies first, does the plain language not cover the situation we're faced with here?
Yes.
Explain why.
Because this involved loaner vehicles, not dealer plates, and because the...
Who owned those vehicles?
I'm sorry?
Who owned those vehicles?
Hunterton BMWs.
And Hunterton consented?
Yes.
So why doesn't the plain language, assuming the reg applies, cover the situation?
Without knowing more about the legislative history, the regulatory history, we don't believe that this
just
regulation
the,
was...
Just the plain language, for starters.
It applies to owned vehicles, yes.
So why should we disregard the reg?
Because it does not appear to apply in this context.
Because?
Because the focus of the regulation and the focus of the Motor Vehicle Commission's authority is on the licensing process, not on issues with respect to the repair of vehicles and loaner vehicles.
Why isn't this a de facto exclusion? Because our state law requires every driver, owner of a vehicle, at 1530. So let's assume that to be the case. And the dealership is providing 1530, which means that it's providing nothing. So why isn't it a de facto exclusion? Are you following me?
I'm sorry, in the context of the regulation or the wording of the policy?
The wording of the policy.
It's not a de facto exclusion. To the extent that you have individuals who don't...
Assuming that just about everyone has 1530, because that's the limit required by law, then what is the dealership offering?
You can certainly envision situations where individuals might not have 1530.
So I know we can envision that. But let's say in the vast, vast majority, people are going to be complying with this 1530, not going to be getting some lesser. Isn't it, a de facto exclusion?
It is, but the point is, the fact that it may exclude coverage in the...
For just about everyone.
Well, perhaps it does, Your Honor, but not all the time. And that's the difference between limiting and excluding completely. And if that was the case, then Aubrey is wrongly decided, because that's the same situation you had in Aubrey. It may well be in most situations people do have insurance of their own, and they would have 1530, and therefore the step-down would apply. But
I thought UIM is optional.
True.
Liability is not. So that puts this case in a different category.
Yes, except you had the same, but for that language in Aubrey, you would have gotten a different result. But this court was not analyzing UIM language in the context of step down at Aubrey. It was analyzing the liability insurance provisions in Aubrey.
That's true, but they were analyzing the liability purpose language for purposes of imposing a limit on the UIM collection of.
That's correct. It was in the context of UIM.
Yes, so I think it is a little bit different than what we're talking about here.
So perhaps. I mean, the point is, the argument is made that there must be coverage for permissive users for the safety of the public. And certainly that's the public policy underlying 39.6b. But this court, in its opinions in Proformance and Potent Zone, has not said that's an unlimited policy. The language is that there should be some protection for the innocent public, not protection up to $10 million, protection consistent with what the statutes require.
Your answer, I think, on with respect to the previous questions would be that there are people out there who are not complying with the law. Well, and in those instances, maybe they're not the majority, hopefully a very small minority of accidents, your coverage would step in on that.
That's correct.
Counselor, since 1998, our legislature has basic policies as opposed to standard policy, which require no that coverage for bodily injury. So people would be complying with the basic policy to carry them now. I don't know how many because it's much cheaper. And this then would not be a de facto exclusion because all those people with basic policies would be provided with a 15.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And that's been so since 1998.
And it may well be that it's crazy to have mandatory coverage of only 15,030, but that's for the legislature to decide. And if they have left it that low, that long, that evidences some intention on their part. My point on public policy is that this court in Potent Zone and Proformance has recognized that there are limitations and that courts are permitted, insurers are permitted to impose reasonable limitations on that coverage. The question was raised in the prior exchanges, where is the basis for, if this is not a step-down clause, how is it that it's only 15,000 or 100,000? And the answer is it's not in the policy. If that is where the court ends up, the doctrine is that insofar as a policy provision is struck down because it's contrary to a statutory requirement, then you reform it as if that statutory requirement was complied with.
So you're saying the maximum that you should be insuring in this situation for is 15,000?
That's correct, Fred.
Even though there's insurance coverage for the 15,000?
We do, and that's my point. There's no public policy or statute saying there should be $30,000 of coverage. It's 15 or not. If for some reason this court disagrees and finds that the step-down language is in effect an escape clause, it's doing so based on a conflict with the statute, and therefore the language of the statute is interpolated into the policy. That would be the basis for doing it. I don't agree with it. I'm saying that's the answer to the question that was raised earlier.
Is it your position that an insurance company can offer a policy to a family and say the insured are husband and wife and all of the children, but every other, and they have 100, 300, and every other permissive user gets 1530? Would that be permissible?
Yes. To the extent that the other people had insurance of their own. The statute and this court's rulings don't require a distinction among different classes of insurance. But the last point I'd like to make is just in terms of the umbrella policy. The umbrella policy is not, it's a clear separate policy. It has express exclusionary language. The case that plaintiff relies on is Martusis. What he ignores in Martusis is the language Martusis is a permissive use case. This is not a permissive use case. What Martusis says is subject to exclusions that might be adopted. Well, that's what was done in this case. There is a limitation that was not contained. There was no step-down language in Martusis, and there's no exclusion in the excess policy in Martusis. So Martusis has nothing to do with this. It's not subject to the Omnibus Act. And again, we believe that not only is there no obligation, but insofar as there's any obligation, it would be limited to $15,000.
Anything you'd like to add?
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Bennett.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm going to be very brief. my client, Honorton Motors, there were two claims against them that were summary judgment was granted below, that there's agency between who's Gadigal and Honorton. There's no evidence to support that summary judgment was properly granted on that issue. The other claim against them is if their policy with Federated does not supply coverage, then therefore they're somehow uninsured. Well, I think everybody agrees there is a valid policy that my client obtained through Federated Insurance Company. Federated is a company that's licensed to do business in New Jersey, so no matter what the coverage is, it must supply the mandatory minimums that New Jersey requires. Therefore, my client isn't uninsured. They obtain an insurance policy, and the insurance policy is valid. Thank you.
Mr. Canelli, brief rebuttal.
Mr. Chief Justice, I don't have anything in particular in response to any of the statements.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you to all counsel for the helpful briefs and arguments. We're going to take this under advisement. The court's going to take a very